Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson. In this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Laurence Bradford, the creator of Learn to Code With Me, her blog that teaches more than 150,000 monthly readers how to get started with becoming a developer. Laurence also runs the Newbie Coder Warehouse Facebook group, her community of more than 12,000 people learning how to code and helping each other along the way. Laurence writes for publications like Forbes, Mashable, USA Today, and she works with Teachable, the online course creation platform. In this episode, we're talking about how Laurence left her first career working in economics, taught herself how to code, began taking on freelance web development projects, started her blog, and then started helping others how to code as well. We're covering her community building strategies that have grown her Facebook group to more than 12,000 members and why that's been one of her best promotional vehicles for her business. We dive into Laurence's systematic approach to getting guest posts on high traffic blogs, how she pitches potential freelance clients, growing her podcast, what it took to become a freelance writer for sites like Forbes, and so much more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Laurence Bradford.
Hey, Ryan, great intro, and thanks so much for having me.
All right. So to start from the beginning, can you tell us a little bit about what you did before making the decision to learn how to code yourself?
Yes. So without getting to the whole story, I thought I wanted to work in economic development, specifically in Southeast Asia. So I go to Southeast Asia, I end up getting like my supposed dream job, and I'm there for about a month when I realize it's just not for me. It's not what I thought it was going to be. Probably the best thing that could have happened, because I was actually planning on going to grad school to study economic development, which of course is a huge time in financial investment. So feeling a bit lost, I started looking online and doing research of possible career paths. At the time, I was really interested in traveling. So I was really interested in like getting remote jobs or being able to make money while I traveled. And a ton was showing up with like technology and coding and building websites. So one thing sort of led to another. I began teaching myself how to code. And then about a year later, I started the blog Learn to Code With Me.
Awesome. So with that blog, one thing that you've done that I really have a lot of admiration for is you've built a community of super engaged people, over 6,000 members on Facebook, I believe. And there are like literally dozens of people posting every single day. So can you tell us what brought you to that point of creating the community based around your website?
Yeah, so the community came a bit later. I started with the blog and I kind of got a handle on that, I guess you could say. The first several months of blogging, it was a little bit of trying this and trying that, seeing what stuck, seeing what kinds of content people enjoyed. And then after that, I'm trying to recall the exact timeline. I think it was a bit over a year later. I decided to start the Facebook group. And the reason was I had heard this quote somewhere. I'm not sure where it originated from. And a lot of people will use it, I believe. People come for the content, but stay for the community. So I was like, how can I, you know, take this beyond just the blog and actually have people communicate amongst one another? So like have my readers communicate with each other and help each other out, especially with something like learning how to code, which can be a really frustrating and challenging and oftentimes really, very lonely undertaking. So when I first began the group, I made the issue of not telling, or it was kind of a problem because I didn't tell enough people about it. The early months, it grew quite slowly. But then once I kind of began promoting it more, it began to grow very quickly. In some ways, almost too quickly, because there's been times, especially having a full-time job and all these other responsibilities, that it's hard to manage the group. And I think anyone with a large Facebook group can attest to that, that it can be difficult at times to keep a handle on it.
Okay, so going back to the first couple of months with your group, how did you find, let's call it the first 100 or so members? Where'd they come from?
So, like, I'm laughing now because I don't think this was like a very good idea. But initially, I would just kind of invite like my friends. And when I say friends, I really mean like online friends. So not my friends in real life, but people I met through Learn to Code With Me, like people who have been reading the blog, or maybe they were doing similar kinds of blogging online. And I just like personally through email or on Facebook, invite them. So and at that point I had the blog for over a year already. So it very quickly got to 50 people. But when it started to like truly take off is when I added it to my email list. And so with my email list, I have like an automation or workflow or whatever word you want, drip campaign that when you first sign up, you go through. And I added an email about the Facebook group to that workflow. I use ConvertKit, and I believe that's the right word for those workflows. And so then it's kind of automated, and then people just began trickling in themselves over time.
Okay, so how were people, I guess, finding your content on your blog and eventually joining your email list?
Yeah, so no, that's sort of like the process, right? Like people come to the blog, they sign up for the email list, and then they go to the group. Caveat, when your group gets bigger on Facebook, they'll start recommending it. So there's definitely people today in Newbie Coder Warehouse who've like never been to the blog, or maybe I mentioned it someplace else that I wrote. Like I know I mentioned it in a Skill Crush article, for instance. So they could have come just from Skill Crush to the group and just going past the blog and the email list. However, how I get most people to the blog, tons of my traffic actually comes through Google. And aside from that, like the most quality traffic and people, I'd say like readers I build relationships with, comes from writing on other sites.
Cool. That makes sense. That's actually a really common theme with pretty much everyone we've interviewed for this course, is that they've been able to get a lot of traction from guest posts and drawing their audience from different destinations. So what would you say has been your first guest post or your first feature on a publication, industry site, whatever that was?
When I first started out the blog, I began guest posting very early on. And especially like the first year or so, I was really aggressive with it. So I would make spreadsheets and I would reach out to a bunch of editors and a bunch of other bloggers and try to get featured on the site or, you know, guest post for the site. And I just have to say, it was definitely took a while to gain traction. I went through lots of rejection. I wouldn't hear back from people. And then over time, it kind of became easier and easier because I also then built up this, I don't want to say like not a formal portfolio, but a bunch of writing samples on other sites that I'd written for. So it became easier over time. But some of the first places I think I wrote for were smaller like coding blogs and like related like blogs that would have a similar audience that I was going after.
And did you reach out to them just cold email, or did you know somebody who knew somebody? What was that process like?
Yeah. So over time, and as like kind of my network grew in the space, like the Learn to Code space, like the online writing space, or the online education space, I could even say as well, it became easier to like meet connections that would give me introductions. But early on, a lot of it was cold emailing. Like I remember the first time I emailed Randall, who was the former head of content at Skill Crush, and they have an awesome blog. And, you know, both of us have written for their blog before. It was a cold email, and I sent it to her at the end of 2014. And I think then I ended up writing my first guest post for their site in early 2015. But that was just, you know, a cold email.
I love that. Yeah, that's also been a common theme of where, you know, we've interviewed Mikhail Cho, who started Crew, and his thing that started Crew was a guest post on Buffer's blog. So it's very common. I love hearing that. So let's fast forward a little bit. You make your very first online course, which is called Portfolio Dojo, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay. And that one's like all about how to build portfolio, sort of angle towards the developers who maybe want to land either their first developing job or go freelance with it. Can you share a little bit about how you landed on the idea for that course?
Yeah. So one thing that So I have all these readers emailing me, right? And telling me like what their frustrations are or why they're learning to code and asking me questions. And a common theme that I saw was questions related to getting a career in tech. Most people want to become web developers, but even broader than that, just a career in tech. And there's so many resources online for learning how to code. Like, just, you know, Code Academy, Free Code Camp, and those are completely free. And of course, there's tons of like coding boot camps and paid options and so on and so forth. But I, especially early on, I noticed a lack of career resources for people that were new to tech. So I kind of saw that as a bit of an opportunity there. So through talking to my audience and just seeing what else was, you know, available online, And yeah, I made a first version of the course in, must have been 2015. And before I ever made it, I had talked to, I talked to a few people through Skype, but a lot of people just like one-on-one through email, maybe even 60 or something, and got feedback from them. And I kind of shared like an outline of the course and what it would include. And they gave me suggestions. Yeah. So I definitely did research before building it.
I love that. I mean, that process you just described is essentially validation for the course, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool. So what kind of feedback were people telling you when you first started sharing, you know, this outline basically?
Yeah. So again, this would have been like in 2015. So my brain may be a little rusty on it now, but a lot of people were just telling me their main like pain points. And that was, you know, getting interviews, feeling like a lot of it's also with tons, so much of it was with confidence, like just having the confidence to even feel like they were ready to get a job, whether it was a full-time job or or even just freelancing, like just even to get their first client through freelancing. So I really then tried to like tailor some of like the lessons in my course to also touch on those issues. Whereas before it was more like tactical, I guess you could say. However, the course, while it is portfolio specific, it does get into some other things, especially towards the end. So things like more generally with building an online presence, so like your LinkedIn profile and other kinds of social media to take advantage of. And I think I even talk a bit about like in-person networking then at the end, because it's really like getting a new career in tech is more than just having a great portfolio. I mean, that's part of it, but there's other things you can do as well.
So we have a lot of people that do want to create courses of their own, but they don't have an audience yet, right? Big problem. How do you recommend, like what pieces of advice, things you've learned, maybe even through work at Teachable, would you give to someone who wants to create a course, but they don't have a big audience and they're trying to decide what their course should be about?
Yeah, definitely echoing what you say, Ryan. Having an audience just makes everything easier, whether you're trying to sell a course, whether you're just trying to, you know, before that validate a course, whether you're just trying to take an audience survey, having those people there already makes things so, so much easier. But as far as building an audience and building an email list specifically, I think your audience probably heard about this, but lead magnets or content upgrades, those are super effective. So if you have like a blog post on your site, and you have some kind of additional guide or like checklist that they can get just in exchange for their email address, that is really effective. And that's, you know, I have a full-time job. I started my job in July and I haven't had as much time nowadays to focus on my blog like I used to, but I still get like 50 new email subscribers a day from these older blog posts that are just really optimized for capturing emails. And again, it's with these lead magnets or content upgrades. So that's super important. And I guess it may be different for everyone, but for me, I mean, getting to the first 1,000 subscribers was so difficult. And then I think like every 1,000, it becomes easier and easier and easier. And maybe once I was at like 10,000, everything became super, super easy. Like as far as like getting feedback from people, sending out surveys and getting, again, feedback, and then using that to create a product or what have you.
All right. So on that note of the first 1,000 subscribers, what would you say were the biggest contributors to driving those first 1,000 people to your email list?
So like getting my first 1,000 was really hard, but my first 100 was even harder because I was just not doing things right. Like on my website, like I just had a little sign up form in the sidebar. Like no one's going to see that and like put their email in. It's just like get on the newsletter. But so, I mean, if you have to start, I mean, start, if you're not collecting emails, start today. And if you have to do it just by adding something in the sidebar, that's fine. At least you're trying to collect some, but definitely do the whole lead magnet thing that I mentioned. So aside from creating these lead magnets that I consider to be pretty high value, I would do, again, tons of guest posting. So I would write on other sites and I would try to write on sites that had an audience I was going after. So people teaching themselves how to code or wanted a new career in tech. And then also ideally blogs or websites that had a large audience. So lots of people coming to their sites, then they could, you know, click over on to mine and hopefully sign up for a guide or checklist.
All right. So shifting gears a little bit, have you had any validation tests that you've tried either yourself or maybe that you've seen at Teachable or with a client you've worked with in the past completely fail?
That's a really good question. So this is not related to a product, but I did an experiment on my site like a year or two ago, and I would say it was a pretty big failure. I kept up with it way too long. Like it was like this like weekly Q&A thing. And the problem was I didn't talk to people before even starting on this endeavor to see if people would find it interesting, which they didn't. And really for that, like the page views and the traffic spoke for themselves. Like my blog articles and other pages on my site would get like 10 times more traction. And I was even emailing people out about these Q&A things. And it just, I mean, that was a total failure. I know that wasn't a product, but that's like the one main failure with my site I can definitely pinpoint.
How did you determine when that was a failure? When to throw in the towel or to, you know, give up or pivot to something new?
So like for me, and I know I should be a little bit more quantitative rather than qualitative, but I really look at the emails people send me. And because when you sign up for my email list, the first email you get from me, it's like an autoresponder. An automated message. It says, thanks so much for checking out the site. If you have a moment real quick, tell me why you're learning to code. And if you know like where you found my site, let me know or something. And just naturally, people would tell me like, well, either where they found my site or what they enjoy the most about the site. So people are like, oh, I found this blog post through Google and I loved it. And tons of people now, the podcast, I get so many people emailing me about how much they like the podcast. With this other little weekly Q&A thing I did, no one told me they liked it. So I'm laughing now because it's like funny, but like literally no one ever told me they liked it. So that was like after kind of like realizing that after a few months, I was like, yeah, this is definitely not worth my time. No one's even noticing it.
So why did you decide to start the podcast in the first place? What were your goals behind that?
So I kind of like with the Facebook group of building a community, I wanted another way to communicate with my audience beyond just writing blog posts. And starting a podcast was really scary for me because I'm kind of like self-conscious about speaking. And even though it's not like public speaking in front of a crowd or a live audience or even like a video, it's still like, it's kind of like a lot more vulnerable than writing. And especially because I feel like I'm quite good at writing and speaking out loud, that wasn't the case. So yeah, it was scary at first, but I'm definitely so happy I did it because I feel like the value that you build with your audience when they're listening to you, like in, you know, their headphones, is so much stronger than reading a blog post. And also for me now, while starting the blog post was difficult because I didn't really know what I was doing, I had to do a lot of research and, you know, microphones, recording, editing, show notes, just getting into the iTunes store. It was all very new to me. But now I actually spend it takes me a lot less time to record a podcast interview than it does for me to write like really high quality content. So yeah, there's like a few reasons why I keep on doing it. And yeah.
What does your workflow look like with your podcast now that you're working a full-time job? I'm curious, like what aspects of it, if any, that you outsource and how you sort of make it more efficient?
Yeah, I almost like want to open like my Asana. I have an entire like Asana project just for the podcast, and everything is very, very much a process. So, and I do have help. I have like lots of help now, especially if I have a full-time job. And when I say lots of help, I mean like the only thing I'm really doing is the interview. And then before the interview goes out, I'll check things over. And I do also upload the podcast to Libsyn, which is like my media host. But aside from that, the audio editing is outsourced. I have a VA that lives in the Philippines and I've had her for a while. She just helps me out part-time, but she kind of like organizes a lot of the stuff with the podcast. I have someone else who does the show notes for me. And I think that's pretty much the main things that are outsourced. So yeah. And as far as like when I didn't have a full-time job, it was so much easier for me just to like schedule interviews. Like I could schedule them anytime during the day, but now I really just do interviews maybe like one or two a week and in the evening, like after 6 PM.
How do you find guests, or maybe better question, at the very beginning when you were starting your podcast, how did you find guests and pitch them on joining you for the show.
Yeah, it was a lot harder then because now the show has actually been out for a bit. And like, I think I have, I should know this, I haven't checked in a bit, but at least over 90, I would say, like ratings and reviews in iTunes. So it's kind of like, it's a lot more like legitimate now. But when I was first approaching people, I didn't have an audience. Like I didn't even have a legit podcast out yet because I did all of my recordings. So I do, sidebar, I do it in seasons. So I did season one recordings before season one came out. Like I took 2 weeks and like batched them all. So the way I got interviews then was mostly like through like friends. So you were on the first season. So it's like, we already had a relationship. We knew each other. So it was a lot easier for me to reach out to you, even though I didn't actually have a real show yet. And likewise with a few other guests. And then I still did, I think, cold email a few people that said yes. And it worked out well. Like compared to like trying to get guest posts or to get guest posts on another site, getting interview guests has been easier because I think it's also a lower commitment for the person. I'm asking for like 45 minutes. They just have to do like, you know, an interview and that's really it for them. So yeah, it hasn't been that difficult.
Cool. All right. So my last question for you, when it comes to validating ideas, building products, connecting with people, what would you say has been your best investment? And that could be financial, it could be in products, tools, services, it could be in time investment, energy, anything.
So, so as far as validating or just like building an audience, what has been the best investment?
You choose, whichever makes the most sense for you.
Oh man. That's a really good question. Okay. So the podcast has been, in my opinion, like very, very successful. So like investing the time, and I did buy like a fairly expensive like podcasting course, which I think definitely paid off because I was able just to like kind of take what they said in the course and just apply it to my own life. So it actually saved me time from doing as much research as I maybe would have before. Oh, and another huge huge investment, at least like financially, that's helped out a ton is having people like contractors help me do certain things. So like the audio editor, for instance, that has helped so much because it's allowed me to focus on other things.
Do you remember the name of the course you got on podcasting?
Yeah, it was John Lee Dumas's podcasting course, which it may be a bit different now. I know he changes his courses sometimes, but when I signed up for it, it was probably even over a year ago at this point, about a year ago at this point.
Cool. Awesome. Well, Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell our viewers where they can learn more about what you're up to and find you online?
Yes. My website is learntocodewith.me. And you can find me on Twitter. And my handle is @learncodewithme.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.